Not all monsters are myths.
Michigan Monsters.
This is Michigan Monsters. A true crime gothic.
Hey there. Welcome to Michigan, where the lakes are salt-free, the monsters are human, and the cults are plentiful. I'm Jen Carpenter, and today we're going to be talking about one of my least favorite topics, cults. For not loving talking about cults, I sure find myself doing it a lot for some reason. I've done episodes on the House of David cult from Benton Harbor, the Mormon pirate cult from Beaver Island, the Children of the Thunder cult from California, which was founded by two brothers from Lansing. And I feel like there have been others, but those are just the ones that are kind of top of mind. And what do all of these cults have in common? White men. These white men are dangerous. Much like when we conjure up images of a serial killer, a very particular type of dude comes to mind when we think of a cult leader. A scraggly, unwashed white dude trying to fashion himself after what he thinks Jesus looked like. Spoiler alert, Jesus was not white, so you already done fucked up right out the gate, right? But not all cults fit that stereotypical dirty Jesus mold, and we're going to talk about two such cults today. One you might have heard of, depending on where you get your news, and one that you definitely have not. And of course, let's start with that one. A cult is defined by the Google as a relatively small group of people having beliefs or practices, especially relating to religion, that are regarded by others as strange or sinister or as imposing excessive control over members. Much like serial killers, cults really became a thing in the 1970s, with some pretty high-profile cases hitting mainstream media, namely the Manson family murders and the Jonestown massacre. But while the rest of the world was transfixed by these headline-grabbing cases, smaller cults were forming all around the country, led by narcissistic men with dangerous ideals. They didn't always live on big, elaborate compounds or go out in a blaze of glory. Sometimes, they carried out their reigns of terror quietly, and right under our noses. The residents of the rundown three-unit apartment building located on East Jefferson Street on Detroit's east side had a certain reputation. They called themselves the Theocratic Commune Natural Health Service, say that three times fast, but the locals knew what they were. A cult. They dressed all in white, they spoke their own language, they operated their own church, and they existed within their own world. Multiple families lived on the property. They subsisted on a diet of raw fruits, vegetables, and nuts. The group made money by selling the produce they grew on the street. The children didn't go to school. Their leader, Hebrew Israelite Raymond Archer, a young black man in his mid-20s with a common-law wife and two young children, seemed to have his subjects under a spell. But it was the 70s, right? Peace, love, and everybody's a weirdo. And it all seemed relatively harmless. Until it wasn't. On Friday, August 4th, 1978, Detroit police received a call from a man by the name of Gregory Midget. I don't know how to actually say that. It's spelled weird, but that's what we're going with today. Gregory claimed to be a former member of Raymond Archer's cult. Not just a member, but family. His sister, Diane, was Raymond's common-law wife. Gregory had somewhat recently parted ways with the group over a rental disagreement, and he explained to officers, once he was out, the spell that he had been under was broken, and he started reflecting on all that he'd seen and heard and done during his time in the cult, and some of it just didn't sit right with him. So he called police to unburden himself. On the very tippy top of that list was witnessing the illegal burials of two children, Raymond and Diane's three-year-old daughter and one-year-old son, so Gregory's niece and nephew. When the police heard this, they went and scooped Gregory up and they drove him out to the Theocratic Commune Natural Health Service, Jesus, headquarters, and sure as shit, right where he told them to dig, they found human remains. The two tiny bodies, wrapped in sheets, were sent to the medical examiner for testing, while 29-year-old Raymond Archer, the children's father, if they were who Gregory Maggiet said they were, was placed under investigatory arrest. While the medical examiner ran tests on the bodies and detectives questioned Raymond Archer, crews dug up the entire rest of the property, but did not find any other remains. Raymond told authorities that, basically, his life was none of their business, that he and his common-law wife, Diane, had had four children, all born naturally at home, no birth certificates, no medical records, no documented proof of their existence anywhere, and that when two of them died, Raymond just buried them on the property himself, no cops or coroner needed. According to their father, the children died because they were just too pure for this polluted world. He said, "It was a matter of them being too young and tender and not being able to adjust to the diet," another quote. That diet was nothing but raw fruits and vegetables and nuts for babies. Raymond explained to authorities that his son, I'm going to butcher these names. I'm so sorry. I don't know how to pronounce these at all, but I'm going to do my best. That his son, Reshorka Benjuda, who was born at home in 1975 and had been breastfed by his mother, died soon after being weaned and put on the strict vegetarian diet that the rest of the cult followed, sometime around 1976, mid-year. His father held a small ceremony in the backyard and then buried him there. A few weeks later, Raymond and Diane's three-year-old daughter, Dewista Benjuda, fell down a flight of stairs and broke her leg. Rather than take her to the hospital, Raymond treated the injury with prayer and exercise and massage. The little girl never stood again. Weak due to years of being subjected to the cult's strict diet and in desperate need of medical attention, her condition continued to deteriorate over the next few weeks. She eventually went blind, and a week or so later, she died. She was buried beside her brother, where she remained for 2 years until her uncle led authorities to their bodies. So the bodies were discovered on August 4th, 1978. Raymond was arrested immediately and held for a couple of days, but on August 6th, he was released with a "don't go anywhere" handshake deal, I guess? Then the medical examiner's office report came back. The body of the baby boy was too decomposed to determine the cause of death, although there were signs of severe malnourishment. The little girl's remains showed signs of a chronic vitamin deficiency resulting in abnormal bone growth, as well as that badly broken right femur. So, for her death, the prosecutor pressed manslaughter charges against her 29-year-old father, Raymond Archer, and 28-year-old mother, Diane Maggiet. On August 10th, 6 days after they found the bodies and 4 days after they released Raymond from custody, they returned to the cult's headquarters on East Jefferson and smashed in the front door, according to the Detroit Free Press. They found the building empty. Neighbors told police that Raymond and Diane had just left by bus with their followers about an hour earlier. A cross-country manhunt ensued, which led authorities all the way to California. 5 days after the arrest warrants were issued, Raymond Archer was picked up in San Diego and extradited back to Michigan. His preliminary examination was held on October 16th, so about 2 months after the warrant was first issued. And I'm going to read you an excerpt directly out of the Detroit Free Press following the hearing because, well, it was weird. It says, "About six exotically dressed members of the group were in court for Archer's examination Monday, the men chewing sassafras roots and speaking to Archer in what appeared to be a language of their own invention. Archer, dressed completely in white, listened impassively while Deputy Chief Medical Examiner John Smalek testified that he had helped recover the child's skeleton, which had been wrapped in several pieces of cloth. Raymond Archer was ordered to stand trial, and he faced up to 15 years in prison, but he was released on $2,500 bond while the trial all, you know that stuff takes a long time, right? Meanwhile, authorities were still looking for Diane, who was gone like the wind. I'm not sure when the trial began, but it ended on Thursday, January 17th, 1980, a full year and a half after Raymond was first arrested. Following closing arguments, the defense filed a motion requesting a directed verdict, aka bypassing the jury and having the judge decide, because he claimed that the prosecution failed to produce enough evidence so that a reasonable person would be able to render a guilty verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge agreed and dismissed all charges. A week later, on January 24th, Diane Maggiet emerged from hiding and she turned herself in so that that same judge who'd exonerated her not-quite-husband could dismiss the charges against her as well. The prosecutor planned to appeal the judge's actions in both cases, but that January 25th, 1980 article about Diane turning herself in is the very last article I was able to find on the case about her, about Raymond, about the cult, about any of it at all. So I have no idea where things went from there. I'm guessing there was no appeal and they just got away with killing their own kids. So we're just left with all these questions here. Like, how? Why? Their neglect killed not just one, but two children. They literally starved their babies to death, admitted to it, and their daughter especially died an excruciatingly painful, drawn-out death. And then they just buried them in the backyard, and there was nothing. There was nothing in all of that that they could charge them with. If they couldn't get the manslaughter to stick, there was nothing else. And what about the other children? Raymond and Diane had two others, and other cult members had kids of their own. What happened to them? Did CPS take them, or at least, you know, step in to make sure they were getting proper care? What happened to the Theocratic Commune Natural Health Service? That is such a stupid name. They never returned to the property on East Jefferson, but did they settle elsewhere? Or did Raymond's trouble with the law create enough space between him and his followers that the spell was broken for them too, and the whole thing just kind of fell apart? We may never know. Unless someone who hears this knows and tells me. That does happen sometimes. That would be handy in this situation. So that's just one of Michigan's many, many cult stories. Here's another, and oddly, it's another Black Hebrew Israelite cult. This one you might have heard about. This one does make headlines from time to time still, and it made some big headlines at the time, but it's still not super well known. Let's talk about the fall of the House of Judah. The House of Judah was a religious cult that operated in the ultra-rural, unincorporated community of Lakota, Michigan in Allegan County, not far from South Haven's infamous Jellystone Park, which is roughly a 2 or so hour drive southwest of my hometown, Lansing. In a 2013 multi-part investigative report, MLive summed it up like this. What started out as a communal group of Black Israelites living under the leadership of a self-proclaimed prophet devolved into a place of despair, where punishment for minor transgressions was meted out in the form of public beatings and disfiguring burns. It was a place where armed guards roamed the perimeter and children were padlocked into a collection of trailers at night. Former U.S. Attorney John Smetanka, now a private attorney, said the House of Judah differed from a Nazi concentration camp in Poland only in its scale. This was Auschwitz in Allegan. So before we can talk about the House of Judah, we have to talk about where all cults get their start, with a delusional man who has a God complex. Despite his delusions of grandeur, self-proclaimed prophet William A. Lewis came from very humble beginnings. He was born in 1921 in the Alabama backwoods, a small town called Wetumpka, 10 miles north of Montgomery, aka the cradle of Confederacy. And when I say he was born in the backwoods, I mean that quite literally. He was born in a little ramshackle cabin in the woods that his parents called home. His father, Joe, was a farmer and an odd job man around town, and his mother, Josie, cleaned houses. Like just about everyone else in the community, the Lewis family attended Galilee Baptist Church. William grew up working on the farm before taking off for the big city at the age of 17. And by the big city, I mean Chicago, some 700 miles from home. He took a job at a utility company and worked there for over 20 years before a fateful walk through the park one afternoon in the 1960s changed his life and ruined the lives of so many others. According to Lewis, he received a calling from God to start his own ministry while he was watching a soapbox preacher scream at people in Washington Park. He began leading religious classes and hosting his own weekly radio program. When he started to garner a following, he decided that they needed to make their own little place in the world. And for some reason, he chose to do that in Michigan. He purchased a 22-acre plot of land in rural Allegan County on Baseline Road near 60th Street, about 5 miles east of South Haven. You know the place. There were a couple houses on the property which Lewis, his prophetess Muriel King, and their 5 children lived in, a few single-story outbuildings used as classrooms and community spaces, and then everyone else. And estimates put this number of cult members between like 80 to 100. They all lived in 25 trailers that Lewis had placed on the property. They called the property the House of Judah. Everything was painted blue and white, and there were signs posted all over with some of the most racist sayings I've ever heard. Like, they were in the newspaper. I cannot repeat them to you guys because they were not racist against white people. If there was anyone William Lewis hated more than the white man, it was the black man. And I've struggled with how to talk about this part of the story as a middle-aged white woman without getting myself canceled, because when I tell you, I was sweating reading some of these articles from the 1980s. Like, they would really just print any damn thing back then. And there were quotes from this man using the N-word with the hard R and just some of the most vile, hateful things I've ever read. It was so wild. I do wish that I could leave this part out because it's very uncomfortable, but racial separatism was a huge part of what William Lewis built his ministry on, and understanding how and why that came to be is kind of an interesting story, but in the most fucked up of ways. So, back in Alabama, when he was still just a young farm boy, one of William's neighbors, a middle-aged black man by the name of Jesse Rawls, who had an affinity for bootleg whiskey, was murdered by an angry mob of white men. And teenage William saw the whole thing. Some folks even believe that this event was the catalyst for him leaving Alabama and moving to Chicago. According to the Detroit Free Press, one evening after a particularly long bender, Jesse Rawls met up with a local white woman. Now, I have no idea what that means, met up. Did he assault her? Was it a romantic hookup? Or did he just like dare to look in her general direction, right? I have no clue. The paper didn't clarify. But whatever happened led to an altercation between Jesse and a group of several white men that started out as physical and resulted in the men all pulling out their guns and shooting Jesse point blank in front of the whole neighborhood, including William. They then turned their guns on the crowd and threatened to come after them next. This was in the mid to late 1930s in the Deep South, so like, of course, there was no justice. A mob of white men murdering a black man for winking at a white woman was the justice, right? This incident had a huge impact on William Lewis, but not in the way you might think. It didn't inspire him to join the fight for racial equality or support the civil rights movement. Quite the opposite. He wasn't mad at the white men for killing his neighbor. He was mad at his black neighbor for making the white men mad and putting himself in that position. Okay, take a deep breath. This is an actual quote. This is not going to be pleasant. This is an actual quote that William Lewis, many years after everything happened, gave to the Detroit Free Press. It was published in the March 9th, 1991 issue of the Free Press. No redactions, no asterisks used instead of letters. It was not censored the way I'm going to censor it here. It was just all the words. And yeah, okay. He said he was a hard-headed N-word that didn't want to listen, didn't want to obey. That man wasn't abused for nothing. He asked for it. A lot of things happened to these N-words down here because they asked for it. They want to be bad, and then they get their heads cracked. So, yeah. Witnessing his black neighbor be gunned down by essentially a firing squad of white men ignited his belief that black people not only shouldn't mix with white people, but that they should be subordinate to them. And if they weren't, they deserved what happened to them. Another quote published in that same article, please don't kill me, it's okay. Remember, this is a black man from the Deep South saying these things. He said, and the Free Press published, "The Klan's not the problem. Black people are the problem. All Martin Luther King talked about was freedom. Freedom with his black, thick-lipped self. I don't hold the genteel white man responsible for any of my problems. The only thing God used the white man for is to punish us." That whole interview was just one of the most hateful things I have ever read in my entire life. And that's pretty crazy coming from a person living in the year 2026 with the government that we have doing and saying the things that they're saying and doing. So this was the mindset of William Lewis. It was his responsibility to keep his people in line so that they wouldn't suffer the wrath of the white man. Here are some other things that William Lewis believed. He believed that the earth was not just flat, but square. I guess I never thought about that. Like, do flat earthers think the earth is a square, or do they just think it's a like a frisbee, right? I don't know. But he thought that the earth was square. He believed that black people are born bad, but can be redeemed through a program of harsh discipline and racial quarantining. He believed that MLK was a fool and that the Ku Klux Klan was just about the truest organization in America. It's another direct quote. I cannot with this man. He was obsessed. He was obsessed with the KKK. And there was even a newspaper article in the 90s about how he wanted the House of Judah to participate in a KKK march that was going to be coming through Montgomery because he supported them and their ideology. And even after they turned him down because the KKK hates black people, that's their entire thing, right? He was like, "That's cool. I get it. No worries. I respect your decision. I still support you." Like, it was the wildest shit to read ever. I think it broke my brain a little bit. And I'm recording here less than 24 hours after doing the bulk of this research. So this is all still pretty fresh for me. And yeah, I think my brain is still a little bit broken from it all. And this was a man that the people believed in and wanted to follow. Crazier things have happened, I suppose. According to former cult members, the early days of the House of Judah were peaceful. Lewis reeled them in with his promises to set them on the path to righteousness, but also by telling them that he knew how to work the system. He'd get them on food stamps and other forms of government assistance, charge them cheap rent on the compound, a 10% tithe, and then they could just keep everything else. But that really wasn't true. Because they were self-contained, they had to pay him for everything. Their food, their firewood, their health care, their education for the kids, child care. I mean, everything had to be paid for. So he marketed it as they were going to have their own money, but really they wound up paying it all right back to him just for the cost of living. Much like that other cult that we talked about a bit ago, the kids went to school on the property, they did their own medical care, they raised their own food. Although I don't believe that they were vegetarians, I didn't read that anywhere. The House of Judah was entirely self-contained, and the members, even though they had no money, they had no reason for it because they had everything they needed on the property, right? They were relatively happy. But over time, things began to change. Armed guards started patrolling the property, both to prevent outsiders from coming in and to prevent members from escaping. They even had a watchtower, which was manned 24 hours a day. Beginning in 1982, members were forced to sign a consent form agreeing to accept punishment for sins against God or, more importantly, against Prophet Lewis. The possible punishments specified in the document included death, banishment, confiscation of material goods, imprisonment, beating, burning, or hanging of not only the adult member signing the consent form, but also their children. Lewis had what was described as a whooping block. It was spelled W-H-U-P-P-I-N-G, a whooping block, fashioned after colonial style stocks. You've seen them. You probably even climbed inside one up on Mackinac Island and had your picture taken. Those like wooden apparatuses with holes for your hands and feet, or sometimes for your head and hands, depending on the position they wanted you in, to hold a person still while they were whipped and beaten. Lewis used his often, made an entire event of public whoopings with onlookers cheering him on. Men, women, and children were routinely beaten with the wooden handle of an axe that had barbed nails embedded in it that Lewis referred to as Big Mac. Like I'm picturing Lucille from The Walking Dead, right? But this was an axe handle instead of a baseball bat. But Big Mac beatings weren't the worst of it. I actually had to stop reading some of the stories from survivors. They were just so fucking horrific, and there were so many of them, and they didn't go into a lot of detail. They just kind of mentioned this, that, and the other, and it was so fucking upsetting because not only were these things happening, but the entire community, including children, watched it happen and cheered it on and encouraged it. A little boy who had his face burned with a hot iron, a man that had hot coals stuffed into his mouth, like serious Game of Thrones type shit right here in Michigan. And not even that long ago, we're in the 1980s. Like, it's crazy. While neighbors could see the whooping block from the road, heard the screams at night, heard unexplained gunfire often, were terrorized themselves by the cult's guards just trying to get to and from their own homes, the House of Judah was largely left alone by authorities until July of 1983, when they killed a little boy. The House of Judah compound was, among other things, a farm. It was basically a self-contained city. Everybody had to work. Everybody had to earn their keep, even the young children. John Yarbo was 12 years old in 1983. He was one of six children born to Ethel Yarbo, a 33-year-old single mother who lived on the compound with all of her children. John had tried to run away before and been caught. He'd promised his little sister that he'd get them all out someday. It was his little brother who'd had his face burned with an iron as a form of punishment. John was not under Prophet Lewis's spell, and the man knew it. So one day, midsummer, when John was caught watching TV instead of doing his chores, William Lewis ordered John out to the whooping block. What happened next is kind of unclear, as there are several different versions of this story in different articles. But according to John's younger brother, Daniel, John was given 200 licks with Big Mac, which was an unheard of number. When he fell limp less than 100 licks in, he was tied to a tree in a standing position until the beating was over. Once he was untied, a member tried to lift him by the ear with a pair of pliers. His brother Daniel tried to give him water, held John in his arms, tried to wake him up, but John never regained consciousness. Other versions of the story tell of torture that took place over several days, that there was an initial 30 licks at the whooping block, after which John could not slash would not eat, drink, or do his chores, started having bathroom accidents, and just was very clearly unwell. And instead of getting him treatment, they saw this as further insubordination, and additional punishments were meted out, including the final beating with a broomstick administered by his own mother. However it went down, an unconscious John was tossed into the back of a pickup truck and driven to South Haven Community Hospital in the early morning hours of July 4th, 1983. He was pronounced dead on arrival. He'd suffered from internal bleeding, a brain bleed, kidney failure, and a spinal injury, the latter believed to be caused by those final blows from his own mother. John's entire body was covered with wounds and scars and injuries, some recent and some a year or more older. His mother, Ethel Yarbo, was taken into custody and charged with manslaughter. Thus began the fall of the House of Judah. Authorities descended upon the compound, at first to take custody of Ethel's five other children and to arrest a few others who had participated in the beating. They found a total of 66 children living at the House of Judah, and like estimates for total population was 75 to 100, so more children than anything else, which is terrifying. The children ranged in age from 2 months to 16 years, and within days, all of the children had been taken into state custody. So at first they only took Ethel's children, and then they took a few more that looked like they were in rough shape. And then the more this investigation went on, they took them all within a few days. As the prosecutor's office worked to build cases against the cult members responsible for John's death, including Prophet Lewis and one of his sons, the county was facing a crisis of its own. They did not have the means to take care of 66 new children within their foster care system all at once. Within a week or so, projections had them going bankrupt within a couple of months, paying for medical care, housing, daycare, all of the things. It was going to bankrupt the city. Estranged family members of many of the children who'd been cut off when their loved ones joined the House of Judah, so, you know, aunts, uncles, grandmas, grandpas, all these people, because right when you join a cult, that's the whole thing. The first thing they do is they cut you off from your loved ones because they don't believe in what you believe in. They don't support what you support, all the reasons. And so these families, when they heard about what had happened, they came, sometimes even, you know, estranged and alienated parents came to Allegan County trying to get custody of these family members that in some cases they had never met or hadn't seen in years since the family had moved on to the compound. And some of them were successful, but not very many. In the end, Ethel Yarbo was convicted of manslaughter for her son's death, and she was sentenced to 4 to 15 years in prison. Two other members, Theodore Jones and Larry Branson, were each sentenced to a year in jail for child cruelty. And then this I only saw mentioned in one article, and it was literally a one-liner, no further explanation. It said that Theodore Jones was also sentenced for some sort of sexual abuse of his own daughter, but it didn't go into any detail, so I don't have any more information about that. Prophet Lewis, his son, and a couple others were also charged with child cruelty, but they wound up being acquitted. Ethel's children remained in foster care in Michigan, but most of the other kids were returned to their parents under the oversight of CPS officials. So some of the kids did wind up placed with estranged family members. Some of them spent the rest of their lives in the foster care system and were adopted out, but the bulk of them were sent right back to the House of Judah. Prophet Lewis, who went on record as to saying that John was whooped because he was a bad boy, a mean and spiteful child who wouldn't do his work, and that God killed the boy because it was his will that a simple beating resulted in John's death, thought he'd gotten away with murder. But he wasn't going to continue to press his luck in Michigan. So he and somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 of his followers packed up shop and fled to Wetumpka, Alabama, Lewis's hometown. The House of Judah resettled on the 40 acres of wooded swampland that Lewis inherited from his father. They bought new trailers, they painted everything blue and white, they put back up their super racist signs that I refuse to tell you about. Listen to me. If an old woman that lives in a trailer in the Alabama backwoods tells you that these signs are racist, the most racist thing she's ever seen, Yeah, that's how bad they were. They were awful. But while they were doing all of that, the federal government was working on something super duper special for the prophet, something that he didn't see coming. The prophecy failed him here. On November 26, 1985, so 2.5 years after John Yarbo's death, a grand jury announced indictments against Prophet William Lewis and 7 of his disciples, including one of his sons and his prophetess, Muriel King, on charges of slavery and civil rights violations stemming from the incident surrounding John's death. According to the indictment, cult leadership conspired to violate the civil rights of the children of the cult by holding them in slavery through fear and intimidation. FBI agents descended upon the New House of Judah compound, and the 6 men and 1 woman were all extradited back to Michigan to stand trial. On September 12, 1986, all 7 were convicted on all charges and faced up to life in prison. But they didn't get life or anything close to it. They were all sentenced to between 1 and 3 years in prison, with Prophet Lewis, who was now 66, receiving one of the longer sentences at 3 years. Lewis was sent to a federal prison in Texas in 1988 to serve his bullshit sentence, and he didn't even serve the whole 3 years. He was released in 1990 after just about 2 years. He returned to his new cult compound in Alabama, and guess who was waiting for him when he got there? Human garbage can Ethel Yarbo, who had served less than half of her 15-year sentence for killing her own little boy. All of her children were still in foster care up in Michigan, but as soon as she could, she hightailed it across the country to the reborn House of Judah. Alabama was a much better fit for Prophet Lewis's religion, according to him. In 1991, he told the Detroit Free Press, and I took a picture from this same article, and this quote from the paper and kind of made a little graphic that I posted on Facebook because it was funny to me. He said, "When I hear Michigan, that makes me nervous. In Michigan, they believed 100% in integration, and I hated that. I'd rather deal with the white man down here." So, I mean, we talk a lot about things to be ashamed of and embarrassed of here in Michigan on this podcast, but man, I guess that's something to be proud of, right? That a super racist cult leader who was also black thought that we were too progressive for him and his cult to be able to thrive. That's good, I guess, right? We got to take our wins where we can, people. Also, the KKK was much more welcome in Alabama than they were here in Michigan, and Prophet Lewis loved him some KKK, even though they did not love him back, because, you know, racism. Race mixing, as he called it, was much less common in Alabama, even though it was the 1990s, and to him it was very important to keep them separated, because Prophet Lewis believed that humans could live 600 years or more if race mixing had never occurred. Listen, that might be the dumbest, craziest thing he said. Not the most hateful, but the dumbest. Like, I don't even want to live 100 years. I don't even know if I want to live like another 50 years. Who wants to live 600 years in this economy? Please. In that same 1991 interview, Wetumpka Police Chief John Montgomery was asked if he had any concerns about the House of Judah rebuilding in his backyard. He said, "We've never had anything on him or against him. Hopefully, whatever occurred up there isn't occurring down here." And William Lewis just could not wait to prove him wrong. On April 22, 1993, ironically, just days after the Branch Davidian siege in Waco came to an end following a deadly fire, cults were a hot topic again, and the House of Judah was back in the news. The day before, ATF agents had raided the compound because Prophet Lewis's teenage son Lemuel had been arrested, along with a couple of other local teenage boys, for a string of residential break-ins in which a total of 14 firearms were stolen. When the weapons were recovered, the stocks and barrels had been sawed off and their serial numbers had been filed down, prompting a federal investigation. Lemuel was determined to be the ringleader of this juvenile burglary ring, but due to his age, he didn't get much time. But a year later, when he did it again, led a ring of teenagers who broke into houses stealing guns, he was tried as an adult. Was he convicted? Who knows? I couldn't find anything else on the case beyond the article about him being arrested and that they were going to charge him as an adult this time. Know what else I couldn't find? Further information about a lot of claims that were just briefly touched on in old newspaper articles. Claims that William Lewis walked around the Michigan compound with a gun, threatening people over this, that, and any old thing. Notably at choir practice, if he felt like someone wasn't singing good enough, he'd point a gun at them. Claims that women were treated as sex slaves and the whole child bride thing was going on. Claims that former members of the cult tried to press charges prior to the death of John Yarbrough, tried to, you know, ring the alarm, raise the warning signal. But their cases were ignored or thrown out due to those waivers that they signed consenting to their own abuse. Claims that two other children died after John's death in a suspicious fire in one of the trailers. And remember, it was said that the children were locked inside their trailers at night. But like all of these things were just mentioned, right? None of them had like in-depth articles or anything about charges being pressed or anything like that. So these are just things that happened within the House of Judas. So don't fall for the hype that this was just a misunderstood religious sect that maybe went a bit too far with the corporal punishment that one time. These were bad people, and William Lewis was the worst of them all. Prophet William A. Lewis died in 2004. He was in his early 80s, and what was left of his cult promptly fell apart. Both House of Judah compounds are now abandoned, or at least they were when they were last talked about in the news. What I want, nay, need to know is if they've ever gone over that property in Lakota with like sonar technology, because there have to be bodies buried out there somewhere, right? There is no way that they didn't kill people and bury them on the property without getting caught, right? Gotta be. The House of David, the Mormon pirate hookers of Beaver Island or whatever they're called, that fucking weird Twin Flames cult up north, they're still active, by the way. Because of the things that I look at, talk about, search on Facebook, I get ads for their like retreats and events all the time. It's so weird, so uncomfortable. These are the Michigan-based cults that we know about. And now we have two more to add to the list. The House of Judah, and the Theocratic Commune National Health Service, which rolls right off the tongue. Both Black, Hebrew, Israelite cults that killed innocent children through their dangerous ideology in the 1970s and 80s. There's a lot of talk about cults in the news these days for some reason, so it feels important to remember just how dangerous they truly are. My sources for today were a lot of old newspaper articles, the Detroit Free Press, the Kalamazoo Gazette. I did find a series of articles on the House of Judah that John Agar wrote for MLive back in 2013 on the 30th anniversary of John Yarbrough's death, and I did pull a few things from there. And MLive just published an article in January of this year, 2026. It was John Agar again, so this is his pet case, right? The article was about John Yarbrough's little brother, Daniel, who is an entire adult now, obviously. Daniel was 9 when his big brother died in his arms, and he was the one I'm pretty sure that I saw mentioned in an old article about having his face burned by an iron. Daniel has written a memoir about growing up in a cult called Misled, A Survivor's Journey from a Cult Childhood. I will read you the overview real quick. Misled is a haunting memoir that exposes the dark reality of life inside the House of Judah. This religious cult masked child abuse behind the veneer of spiritual devotion. Read this impelling story through the eyes of a young boy who survived unspeakable trauma. His story reveals how false leaders can destroy families and steal childhoods under the guise of divine authority. Misled is more than the beginning of a survivor's tale. It's a compelling narrative that forces us to confront uncomfortable questions about faith, family, and the fine line between religious freedom and criminal abuse. It reminds us that sometimes the bravest thing we can do is tell our truth, no matter the cost. Normally, I would tell you guys to come buy this book from me at Dead Time Stories, but this one was published through Amazon, so I think it's only available there. I did check my distributor and I can't order it. So, one time only, don't make a habit of it. I'm going to direct you to Amazon to buy a book. Again, the book is called Misled, and the author is Daniel Israel Yarbough, Yarbough. And that's it for me today, friends. For even more Great Lakes true crime, be sure to check out this week's episode of Already Gone, wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up with all things Michigan Monsters, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram under Michigan Monsters Podcast, on TikTok under It's Jen Carpenter, and online at MichiganMonstersPodcast.com. I am Jen Carpenter, and I'll see you next time. Until then, remember to keep your doors locked, even during the daytime, because not all monsters hide in the dark.